But first of all, I always am overcome with emotion coming into this Beit Knesset, beautiful Beit Knesset. I see the growth, not just in the physical growth, spiritual growth of the whole Kehila, and with my brother at the helm, Baruch Hashem, and how much it's accomplishing and how much it's changing the whole Beit Shemesh, I believe, with all the different learning programs. It's Baruch Hashem. For me, it's supposed to be connected in this way to the Beit Knesset. So it's Hashem, Mishat, Baruch Shadi, Marv, Yomim, Amon, Lato, continue to be Marv, Mishat, Tarev, Hashem, and the Beit Knesset should continue to grow. Okay. This year I'm going to take a slightly different tack than I've done in the past. Sometimes I talk on Jewish, sometimes I talk on Lato. And this time, we're going to be discussing Jewish history, of course, based on Midrash HaKal, based on the Pesukim, but also based on archaeological artifacts and findings. And this is thanks to my good friend, the Chassadik of Bracha, Hakohen Gadol of Yehuda Landi, who was Nifter not so long ago, leaving the Almana. And the oldest one, the girl got married a week or so before he was nifter, and he has two boys under that. He was very unique in the sense that he was able to put together ideas from Chazal together with ideas for his knowledge of secular history, his knowledge of Divrei Chazal. He had a phenomenal memory, but more than that, he had a phenomenal atmata. His wife told me just recently that Lili Ishmael's parents, when the year was over, he made a seum in Bali and Yerushalmi over the year. And that's who he was. He was a person then that really knew that, not only that, the Midrash HaKadal of all sorts as well. All Midrash. And because he had a special interest in his youth in Eretz Yisrael and the topology, the history, things that have to do with the place that we're actually standing on, the rocks that we see when we walk outside the door, we always pay attention to these type of midrashim, and because of that, he was particularly bucky, expert in those midrashim. And as far as archaeology, besides taking from archaeology courses, and going to Zalman Karen, among others, he also became friendly with all of the leading archaeologists, from shoulders with every name that you've heard of that deals with archaeology in Eretz Yisrael, and who went around to the museums around the world that had artifacts from the last 150 years or so. Archaeology became a science, even less than that, and the artifacts were brought to different museums, starting with the British Museum and, of course, many other museums and local museums, even in Arab countries. In America, there's a few different museums that have artifacts from different periods that pertain to this Eretz Yisrael. So anyhow, that's my introduction. He was like the prince in English and in Hebrew. Three major works on Jewish history and working together with his knowledge of all the different archaeological findings. So he has Korban of the Persian Empire, his first. He has also an Yirmiyo and the Korban of Hayat, the second, and he also has an Yehoshua and the period of entering Eretz Yisrael, which is just now printed in English as well. Besides that, he has a very scholarly and Tarazik work on the borders of Eretz Yisrael, and it's a work on Midos that's ready to be printed, from what I understand. And it goes on and on. He had a lot more than he planned to do, and Kesh Baruch took it, so took him away from us, unfortunately, too early. So, I'd like to discuss Purim, and I found a lot of interesting auras over here, a lot of interesting pointers here that gave me a new look at the Pesukim, and I was able to use them to understand different midrashim and Pesukim, and I'm sure you will also. So it's more the Mishper Kroy, which means explaining the Pesukim, explaining what the Divrei Chazal mean, but having the background of also knowing the full picture, is able to add to our understanding. As he brings in his introduction over here, the Ramban faces halakhic rulings on archaeological findings, and he brings sources for other sources for that kind of use of what we find not in the Dibre Chazal, in order to complement Dibre Chazal. The books are available, and all proceeds, of course, will go to the Almana and family. Okay, so let's get started. There are, we know, the four Golios after Egypt. There's Babel, right? There's parts of Mada, Yavon, and Rome. Now, Babel were the ones, the Babylonians were the ones that exiled Bnei Yisrael from Eretz Yisrael, meaning they destroyed the Beit HaMikdash and took over now. But even before that, Asher, the Assyrians, had already sent the ten Shvatim outside of Eretz Yisrael. The ones that Babel sent out were the two and a half Shvatim that were left. That was Yehuda and Binyamin, maybe. But Asher and Babel were ruthless, brutal nations. They're known among all historians and to the world for their brutality, and the pictures on their walls were showing how brutal they could be. That's what the kings were like, and I think it's safe to assume that when a king acts in a certain way, and he shows this off to the whole nation, this is more or less the way the nation follows. So I'm working with the assumption that what we see from the king probably reflects, to a large extent, the way that the nation felt and acted. After Asher and Babel exiled the Jews, along came Korah, Daryavish, and Koresh took over from Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, Belshazzar, in the famous party with the hand wrote on the wall, many tekel parson, and that was the end of Shalos Babel. Now, Koresh, the first thing he did at the beginning of his kingdom, he already started to allow the Jews to go back to Eretz Yisrael, to build the walls of Yerushalayim, and even to build the Beit HaMikdash. And as not only that, he even sent back all those stolen vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, the clay Beit HaMikdash that Nebuchadnezzar had taken. So it was 5,400 of them. It was 4,500 of them, I mean. 4,500 of them. That it's listed in the Pasuk, it describes it, the breakdown even. It says that Koresh gave these, he took these from the treasuries of Nebuchadnezzar and gave these to Zerubbabel and to take to Shephetah, to take to Eretz Yisrael, and to build the Beit HaMikdash. So we find in the Rashi and Daniel Tarjusas, Apal Pishahai Yisrael, Meshua, Badim, Lamache, Parat, Parat. Meaning that in Paras, everything changed. It was a whole different world. It was like leaving Russia and going to America as a marshal. And we can imagine why the Jews fell for joining the party of Achashverosh over here. The king not only treats us like equals, but even invites us to the party. This was something that they hadn't experienced for many years. The only blemish in the mouth of Parat and in the Persian kingdom was those few days of Haman, when Haman had decreed to destroy Klal Yisrael, which really lasted only like 3 days. It says that the Yisrael fasted, Lail V'Yom, for 3 days. In any case, and even then, not everybody knew about it. It was Esther and Mordechai that knew about it. And Haman was from Amalek. He was trying to destroy Klal Yisrael. He did persuade Ahasuerus to join him. But afterwards, Mordechai was made the vizier. He was given tremendous power in the court of the king. And Esther's son, Daryavash, according to the Midrashim, was the one that encouraged Nehemiah to go and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and build the Beit HaMikdash. So it went back to the way it was before. This wasn't just for the Jews, this was for all the nations. Archaeological records show how most of the inscriptions that Koresh wrote and Daryavash wrote were in three languages, in the major languages of the kingdom. The kingdom was 127 Medina. It was a very powerful kingdom. And they respected every nation and gave each nation their commands in their language and their iktav and their handwriting. In the palaces of Nebuchadnezzar, you see him poking out the eyes of his enemies. In the palaces of the Persian kings, there are stories of palace life, how people put taxes to the king on the first day of the year, and how the king would eat, and things like that, what the soldiers looked like. But no wars, no fights, no. That was a whole different type of relief than what we find by the other kings. Randy Landy points out, and the other things I said also about the different languages, all these are things Randy Landy points out. And how did they. Now, they were extremely wealthy. They're an extremely wealthy nation. How did they become so wealthy? So, it's, I read a little bit about what he says about the booty that Alexander took when he captured Shushan. Alexander was the first king of Greece, and they're the ones that took over from the Persians. And when he captured Shushan, he found 40,000, and some say 50,000, talents, that means kikre kesef, besides other valuable items. And then there's another location where he found even more than that. He needs 20,000 mules and 5,000 camels to carry it away. In short, Persia was an extremely rich nation. Where did they get all their money from? You see it in the Megillah. The Megillah talks about how they were sitting on couches of gold. The description of the party of Ahasuerus is mind-boggling. And we would think it's an exaggeration, except that when the Greeks discuss the Persians, they talk about couches with legs of gold, couches embroidered with gold, and silver and other things, and drinking cups. All the kings' drinking cups are all gold and silver. So we see that that's actually what the Megillah says is exactly how it was. So one way that they became rich was, according to the Medrash, it says that when Nebuchadnezzar died, he was quite wealthy in his own right, but he didn't want his son to take it over. He wasn't on good terms with his son. So what did he do? He filled both with his gold and his silver and sank them in the Euphrates River, the River Prat. So it says in the Medrash that how did Ahasuerus become so rich? Because when Koresh said that I'm going to allow the Jews to go to Yerushalayim and build the Beis Hamikdash, Akadosh Baruch Hu revealed to him the hidden treasures of Nebuchadnezzar. And he learned this from a pasuk in Yeshayah. It says, "Kol Hashem Amar Hashem LeMeshicho LeKoresh Asher Tzavti BiYamino." It says, "Liftoyach Lefonav Lasayim Musha'arim Lo Yisagera." I'm going to open gates for him. Dalsos Nechusha Hashaber Ubriche Barzel Agadeya. I'm going to break the gate. V'Nasati Lefa Otrot Choshe Umat Munei Mitzarim. L'Man Tezek Yini Hashem Aperi Bishol Peitron. So, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised he's going to break gates and give him treasures. So according to the non-Jewish historians, Derlandi points out, what Nebuchadnezzar did in Bava was he built many canals from the Euphrates River that went right through the city in order to bring drinking water to the city. This was before the days that the Greeks or Romans came up with the aqueduct. And he brought the canals from the Euphrates, which is not far, into the city. But now, he can't leave it like that because then any enemy that wants to come in just brings a boat and floats right up to the center of the city. So he built large gates that went straight from the bottom, underwater, the bottom of the canal, until on top to block any enemies from coming in. What Koresh in English is Cyrus the Great, they call him. What King Cyrus did was he diverted the water of the Euphrates from the canal. And now, Bava was high and dry. He walked in, by then the gate must have been quite rusty. He broke right through the gate and marched his entire army straight in. So if he dried out the waters of the canal, then he very well would have found the treasures that Nebuchadnezzar sank to the bottom of the canal as he was marching in. So That's one way to become rich. It's Gemaras that talk about how the riches of Yosef went through different Gilgulim until they eventually ended up in Persia. And in fact, it's Midrash that talk about the Kisei of Shlomo, how it was captured by Egypt, and Parnachol was one of the people that tried to walk up onto it and didn't succeed. And when Ahasuerus wanted to get to the Kisei, but in the end he saw he's not going to be able to use the Kisei, according to Targum Sheni, so he made himself a replica of the seat, of the throne of Shlomo, of King Solomon. They actually found, says Rilandi, some dishes in the treasury that still remain till today of the Persian kings that sit on a Parnachol. He had a signature on it. It's called a cartouche. It's a special type of signature the kings of Egypt used. And we know that they did take over from the treasures of Egypt as well, because Egypt was part of the kingdom then. It was, they basically ruled over the entire civilized world. When it says Meas Meshev Medina, it means the entire civilized world. It was the biggest kingdom that was, and it's known as the richest kingdom that was. And it's in the Pasuk in the Gilgamesh, it describes as Mehodu Kush. And those are the same words that King Darius the Great was, according to the historians, the son of Cyrus, the son-in-law of Cyrus the Great, who ruled after him. And he has many inscriptions, most famous being the Hit Stone inscription, which is on a large cliff in India, where he wrote in three different languages the whole story about how he's the king of all the world and the king of all the kings, and he shows pictures of all the different nations standing there in nooses and being captive and serving him. So that's how they were able to learn how to read cuneiform, because it was written in different languages, so in different tabins, so the scientists were able to learn the way to understand the different tabins, just like by the famous Rosetta Stone helped understand hieroglyphics. So this was Darius the Great, and when he describes his kingdom in a foundation stone, they used to put stones in the foundations, like Evan Apina, he put a stone, a special stone written up by the foundations, but Darius is with gold, pure gold, a whole big sack of gold and silver, two of gold, two of silver that were found, they were buried in they were dug up. And he writes, my kingdom is from Hodu to Kush. That's in the south. And in the north, there's other cities that are named. Rivlandi points out that the south is probably what interested the writers of the Gilgamesh, and actually Knesset Harkatayla, because that's where Israel was. So Hodu to Kush would be the extent of the kingdom. It took 3 months to travel each way from the center of the kingdom to one side, and sent the kingdom to the other side. 3 months. They, because they had to send decrees from one side to the other, and they can't wait 3 months for it to get there, they were the inventors of the Pony Express. In other words, they might have had a Camel Express. I don't know what they used in the Megillah. It's called the Hashtron of Nehra Motin. And they were special camels or animals that were trained to go as fast as they can. And they had like a relay race where they go to one place and there'd be somebody waiting there to take over and to start fighting, and they'd be able to cross it in 2 weeks. That's the inspiration for the Pony Express of America. So despite their tremendous wealth, the Gemara does say, "Bishloshes varim ayav v'niyasa parsiim." It says that the parsiim are tenuim. They're not tenuim tenua. Tenuim with a sakise, and then tenuim. Says Vati Lotan and Tnuim Badavar Akher, the Tashmish. They were Tnuim, but and the Maral writes that it reflects on Ahasuerus as well. But Rivlandi points out there's no picture of women anywhere on the palace walls, and what we see from the remains of the palace walls. Even the queens that were buried weren't buried in extravagant tombs that were carved out in the cliff or something like the big kings were buried, but they're buried in much more tzanua tombs. And according to the Medrash, Rivlandi points out, Ahasuerus regretted asking Vashti to come with Keter Malkus and nothing on but her Keter. He felt bad after he said that, you know, she was right, and I was wrong. He was drunk when he did that, but in general, the persons were tzanua. What did they do, though? What stood out by the Persian, what was the main trait that Chazal saw in the Persian. In the Gemara in Kedushin, it says that when you see a Persian, when I see a Persian, I call him Dubanaita, a running deer, a restless deer. In the Pasuk, Daniel says that he sees a vision, there's a vision of Aruch Heba, Achim Tinyana, Daniel Adai, in the vision of the four Chayot, the dove, the deer, represented Persia. So what's it mean, Dubanaita? It says in the Gemara, of course, they're fat like deers, and they're also always restless, looking for more. In other words, they're always looking for more food and more physical pleasures. In other words, they're very worldly. The Persians were very worldly. That's how Chazal looked at the Persian nation. A worldly nation, a nation of gashmius. And in the Megillat Esther, you find more mentions of Mishdev than in many other books combined. And that's the way they lived. The Persian kings were known, Rezani points out, for scouring the kingdom for wine. The Persians weren't good historians. They weren't so interested in history. It was the Greeks that invented, basically, the study of history. And Herodotus and many other historians among the Greeks kept records and wrote back records from the more ancient times. And we learn a lot about the Persians from them. And Josephus was also following that path. He also talks a little about the Persians, but in the Greeks we find that they used to send messengers all over the kingdom to find the best wine. They were very known for partying, and even when traveling, they couldn't go without their entire tableware and their party cook. You know, you see what he says, if Lundy brings on page 51. Over here, he says, it says the way Herodotus describes the banquet of Xerxes, that's the son of Tiberius, the Xerxes' traveling tent, when he went traveling. Treasures there in plenty, tents full of gold and silver furniture, couches overlaid with gold and silver, bowls, goblets, cups, all made of gold, wagons loaded with sacks of gold and silver basins. It is said that when Xerxes lost his war against Greece, he left his tent behind, and when the Greeks eventually captured it and saw it, then he said he summoned the cooks that were there watching the tent and said, "Well, prepare me a meal the way that he used to prepare for Xerxes." So they did that, and when the people that were there saw the gold and silver couches, all beautifully draped, and gold and silver tables, everything prepared for the feast, they could hardly believe their eyes. In any case, this is the way he traveled. You can imagine what it was like at home, and that's exactly the way the Sukkim describes the feast of Ahasuerus. They drank from very large cups, and I'll show you on page 54, the type of cup that they drank from when they drank their wine. It's called the Raitan. A Raitan, he has one on page 53. He has a big one on page 54. That's a Raitan. It's so big that you couldn't really hold it from the top, so they had this bottom thing on the bottom. And this particular one is engraved. It's made out of gold, pure gold, and it looks like a lion. And that's what they would drink from. And you see pictures of him on the walls where he's drinking from these kinds of things. The top right on the next page, 55, you see a nice collection of tableware, all gold and silver, including two of these writings and bowls. Everything gold, and the glass is even more expensive than the gold. So this is the way that the Persians live. This is life for the Persians. So let's move on now and try to figure out where Ahasuerus fits into this story. As we mentioned, there are kings of Persia. Cyrus the Great was the first one. Chazal, the Pasuk says that he was together with Daryavish HaMadi, Darius the Mede, and they made a joint kingdom of Persians and Medes, and he repeatedly emphasized in the Megillat Esther. After Cyrus, Chazal mentioned, after Cyrus, after Koresh, Ahasuerus. So we can look in the historian's records for who's the king after him. It's not so simple, because Rashi already brings from Josephus that there's another king that was in between named Cambyses. Cambisa, as Rashi says, and Josephus called him, and he's recognized by historians, and it could be there are others also. He's saying, Rashi says, let's explain a pasuk. So who is this Xerxes? Who is Ahasuerus? There are kings named Xerxes and named Artaxerxes. Xerxes and Artaxerxes. The first one after Koresh, there is Koresh, Tyrus the Great. Then there is Daryavish, the Parsi, not a Bodhi, not a Median. There is the Parsi, the son-in-law of Cyrus, Darius the Great. Those are the greats that we mentioned before. After them comes Xerxes, and his son is Artaxerxes. And then there's another Artaxerxes that is more powerful after him. According to many Rishonim, this Artaxerxes could be the most powerful, the richest of the kings. So who is then the real Ahasuerus? Well, the Josephus, not Josephus, but the Josephus, Blandi brings, he says that Artaxerxes was Ahasuerus. And there's some Midrashim that do say that who Ahasuerus, who Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes is Artaxerxes. It's clear, the Arta and Arta is the same. But, despite that, the word Xerxes is a Greek word, and it's because they couldn't pronounce the Persian letters of the alphabet very well. And in fact, Ahasuerus is also, it's a Hebrew or Aramaic word that was used by the Jews to pronounce the name of the king. What was the name of Xerxes? What was his real name? Well, we find this as a Rabbanian Aramaic inscription, written in Aramaic letters, from a Jewish community in Egypt, in southern Egypt. And over there it spells out, Chash Yarsh. Chash Yarsh. That's how it's spelled out. So, this, in chapter 4, he talks about the name of who the Ahasuerus is, and over here, he brings up a picture on page 41 of the inscription that's in cuneiform, which reads Chashyash, Chashyash. Okay, could that have anything to do with Ahasuerus? Well, the Aleph at the beginning of Ahasuerus is certainly an addition. That's something that's common in Aramaic, like Paklaya becomes Aspaklaya, and there are other words like that. And that's because you can't really pronounce two. A shva in the beginning of the word would have to be with a shva no. So you can't pronounce chashyash, chashyash, the ches would be a shva no. You have to make it achshyash. So that's the aleph. Right? This is, I'm glad to bring someone else that points this out, one of the Jewish observers from 1973. And the end of the word, which is arsh, is also something that doesn't fit into the kololi adiktuk, something that you'd find in a Hebrew word. Now, it's true that kololi adiktuk, the words of diktuk should apply to Hebrew, but when we are trying, the purpose of kololi adiktuk is to make things easier to pronounce. So when we adopt the name of a foreign word or a foreign minister, a foreign person's name, we also apply to it the kololi adiktuk to make it pronounceable. And at the end, this yarsh, you don't find that the ashva no at the end of a word, unless it's beged kefes. There's a few very rare exceptions. You can find some hard letters, but the shin at the end, it just wouldn't go. So it became, so it would be, Achshiyarosh. What about the yud? The yud could be easily turned into a W, because it was hard to pronounce Achshiyarosh. So it's Achshwarosh. Achshwarosh is the W. Of course, it's above. Until today, the same name, so we use W for above. So it's a wow. So that's Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus. So Xerxes really is very clearly Ahasuerus in terms of reading the name. If we would write the name that the Greeks called Xerxes, which is Ahasuerus, in Hebrew it would be Ahasuerus. So it's pretty much agreed upon by the historians today, that he would be the Ahasuerus of the Megillah. This one, the son of Daryavesh, Koresh, Daryavesh, Xerxes, Ahasuerus. He would be the one that the whole story happened with. And he actually was quite a powerful king. There are midrashim even that do say that Ahasuerus' father was Daryavesh. is the beginning of Targum Sheni, and Vilandi counts five Midrashim that say that even though in the Gemara and Megillah it looks like you had Kodesh, and then you had Achashverosh, but there are Midrashim that say that. So it's not clear. It could be that the Gemara lumped together dynasties with kings, and Achashverosh may mean include his father and his son also. But in any case, Achashverosh then could be Xerxes. As we said, the kings of Paras and Madai work together. There's a joint kingdom of Paras and Madai, which means that when there was even a Persian king, the Medians and the Persians worked together. And Rav Landi points out that there was an elite unit. There's an elite unit of the Persian army that only included Persians and Medes. Of course, since they had such a wide kingdom, they took soldiers from all the different nations that were serving them. But the elite unit was only Persians and Medes. 10,000 Persians and Medes. On page 47, he shows a relief from the palace. Over here you see that there are soldiers standing on the wall of the palace. And some of them have hats that have like corners on top. Some of them have rounded hats. So the ones with the corners on top are Persians. The ones rounded on top are Medes. In the palace, every single picture had an equal number of Persians and Medes. And in fact, this is later forgotten in history. Historical records forgot totally about the Medes because they didn't really produce many kings. Well, you have Sayyavish Amadi, another king, a Persian king. But there was a Persian and Mede kingdom, and that was one of the ways that the historians knew all along that the story of the Megillah has got to be very historically correct because it keeps on mentioning everywhere, Paras and Madai.
Did that punish it when the Medes come to Persia?
No, the Druid kingdom is still, you still have Paras and Madai.
You don't have any hidden Darius, you don't have Media anymore after.
You do. They consider the Medians and the Persians to be in equal standing. They were both considered the rulers of the nation. It was the Persian Mede kingdom. And the Persians and Medes didn't pay taxes because they were from the ruling nation. Okay, so let's move on a little bit and try to figure out where Shushan is now. So if we have a king being Xerxes, so where is Shushan? Obviously, it's the capital city, the city where the palace of the king was. So, Binyamin Bitutela, the Kasev Apera, going back to times of the Rishonim, mentioned it as being Shushtar. Today it's called Shush, and it's in Persia, and in ancient texts that were found there, it says Susa, or that's really not quite the way the Persians pronounce it. The way they pronounce it is more like Shushan, very close to Shushan, and that's very clear that that's the place where Ahasuerus' palace was, and that's Shush of today, and there actually are ruins of a phenomenal palace over there, a tremendous palace. It's not very much left today, and you can see what it is, and on page 22 and 23, it's a beautiful aerial view. This is not something ancient, this is something that the early French archaeologists in the early 1900s or 1800s built for themselves out of the stones from the archaeological sites. They're not very good archaeologists in those days. But in any case, over here you can see the palace remains. There's this entire hill over here. And they found in the foundation stone that Darius left that exactly how he built it and how much he invested in it. Phenomenal investment. Darius's records remain more in his second palace. Darius and Xerxes, son of Darius, had a second palace in a place called Parsa, obviously related to Persia. Today it's called Persepolis. That's the Greek name. So they had two palaces, it turns out. The one in Shushan is totally destroyed, except for what you see here. And the one in Persepolis, much more remains. And when we talk about the reliefs on the walls, we're talking about that palace. Why do they need two palaces? Rav Landi points out that in Rashi and Amos, he finds that there's such a thing as Beis HaKayas and Beis HaKayas. Rashi says the ways of kings were that they had a summer palace and a winter palace. So in Shush, in the area of Shushan, it's torture in the summer. It's very hot. It's not that he didn't live there, and it's very probable that that was the winter palace. And as Rulandi points out, all the events in the Megillah occurred in the winter. All the dates are dates in the winter. And even when you think about the 180-day party, why do you make a 180-day party? He probably started it when he came to the palace, the beginning of the winter, and ended it Yom Kippur or so. In fact, the Yaar Shvach says that the last 7 days of Shivas were from the Seretz Yemei Tshuva, the 7 weekdays of the Seretz Yemei Tshuva. And there's a Medrash that says, relates the party to Sukkot, the 7 days of Sukkot. So it would have ended around then. It would be, no, then it would come out the other way. Then it would be in the summer. No, so that's what it is. But according to this way of looking at it, then the 180 days would be in the winter. So in any case, so then it would end by Pesach, it wouldn't end by Sukkot, so it would be not like those Majoshim. So in any case, 180 days might have been because of that, and that's why we find the Kodesh Adar, the Kodesh Teves, other things like I mentioned. The
group
was
I'm
going to
take the
travel
from
Palestine. Oh, it must have taken a few weeks. It wasn't so close. It wasn't very far, but it probably took him 2 weeks. And he had a travel, but with all the royal entourage and all the caterer, of course. Yeah. Then
the palace and church had the river.
Yeah. There's a river nearby. The river is called Ulai in the Psukim. And Rulandi points out that there's a moat and a bridge, which they obviously diverted the waters of the river so that it should make a moat around the hill where the palace was. So over here is the river, and they had a moat, they diverted the rivers over here so that they had a moat over here leading into the main door that would go into the palace. And when it says in the Medrash, Vayavar Mordechai, She'avar Urka Demachma Demaya, that he went over a stream of water, it's referring to that, going over to the city, because the city was on the other side. The royal palace was on top of the hill, much higher, and the city was on the other side, much lower. In fact, Rulandi points out that we see that Darius describes how he dug all the way down to the bedrock, and then he put loads and loads of gravel and raised this amount of amos and another bunch of amos. And it comes out that the palace was like 30 amos higher than the city. And Rulandi brings a medrash that says, the advisors of Haman told him, why don't you build a tree that's 50 amos so that when you're eating with the king, you could see him and you could enjoy watching your enemy who's hanging on the tree. It was because the city was 30 amos lower. You had to make a 50 amos tall pole. I'd add, maybe it would be 20 amos higher. It wouldn't be higher than that because then it says in the Aaron Shoyla, the Lamala Nesimana, the eye doesn't catch well with the eye of 30 amos. So in any case, that's why he made such a tall pole. And he even has a picture over here of where you could see the city of Shushan from the palace, and in the view you could see one building that's sticking up. It has a spike on top of it that's pointing up, and that's what you could see from the city. You can't see the rest of the city. Now why is that? What is that building with the spike? That's interesting. The Rishonim that talk about Shushan say, we found in Shushan the kever of Daniel. Now, that spike is from the top of the kever of Daniel, which until today can be seen in Shushan, in the city of Shush. And he has some pictures of what it looks like inside the kever. So in any case, over here, page 79, he has a picture. Here you can see this is the kever of Daniel on the bottom, and this on the top left, and over here where my finger is, you can see the building with the spike on top. That's the kever of Daniel, and tall enough that you can see it from the remains of the palace on the other side. Okay, so according to the Midrashim, we know that Achashverosh built up the palace at Shushan. And he made the Kisim Achus over there, and the foundation plates that were found describe that clearly, that Darius says, I'm the one that initiated the building, and I finished it, and then Achashverosh has his inscriptions in various places saying that I also built over here, And what's accredited to him, interestingly, is the Beit HaNoshim in the two palaces. The palace in, we know more about the palace in the south than the palace in the north, which was Shushan. And the one in the south, we know that he's credited with either building or adding to the Beit HaNoshim, the Harem. And which makes a lot of sense, according to the Megillah, he collected more girls than ever were collected before in the kingdom. And the Greeks already knew the Persian kings for having tremendous harems. So, there's a machlokas in the Medrash as to whether, in the Gemara also, as to whether Achashverosh was fit to rule or was not fit to rule, did he take over? So, Rav Landi points out that if Xerxes, on one hand, he writes, I was not the first son of my father, and nevertheless he chose me to be the ruler. So in that sense it could be they was not fit. On the other hand, the Greeks write about him that there was nobody that was more appropriate to lead the armies than Achashverosh, which means that he was a capable commander, and in that sense he was fit. So both could be true. Now, interestingly, Vladi brings from other archaeologists that found loads of names that are mentioned in the Megillah that do come up on cuneiform tablets. They found tens of thousands of cuneiform tablets, not in Shushan, but in the other palace. And over there you find names like Muhammad, Bixa, Karkat, Merit, Martin, Memuchan, the idea of Sheva Reishnei Melech, Hamdasa, even the name Mordechai, and the same tablet that has something mentioned about Shushan, Parshan Dasa. These apparently were Persian names. Mordechai is Marduk, it's the Persian god. Elam Roda calls himself Marduk based on that. So these were common names. I don't think that these were the ones mentioned in Megillah. But Rav Landi did find one that probably was one that was mentioned in Tanakh. It says there's someone called Data Mitra, who's appointed on the treasury, according to the tablet. In Ezra, the one that Kairos asked to take out the kelim from the treasury and give it to the Jews to build the Beit HaMikdash, the clay Beit HaMikdash, his name was Mitra Dat. So it could very well be that that's the same one that's mentioned. Talking about linguistics, we mentioned that Achashverosh has to add an Aleph, so we could also know what the Achash Darpanim are. And the Pasuk in Daniel talks about how Kores divided the kingdom into 120 Achash Darpanim. And the Megillah keeps talking about Achash Darpanim, which is either the regions or else the people that were appointed over those regions. And in English, they refer to the regions that the Persians had were referred to as satrapies, or shatrapim, or chastrapim. And the aleph that's added, achastarpanim, is the same aleph as achashverosh. Those are the different regions. In fact, the name Purim also comes from a Persian word, quite obviously. And Landi shows us a picture of a puru on page 74. Here's a puru. This looks remarkably like a die from a set of dice. There's others that he found that even have numbers on them. Some that they're humming through in order to decide when to possess time to take over, to destroy the Jews, according to the Mazzolo. In the palace itself, the largest part was called the largest room of its own, which is called Apadna. Apadna is an Aramaic word that's used in the Gemara, in Baba Batra, in numerous places, and in the picture that we see over here, here's the palace, and here's the Apadna. The Apadna was the place where the king could make parties and invite guests over. You don't see much of it over here, there's not much left of it, this is all that's left. And you can see over here on page 51, of Rav Landi's book. He has some pillars in the southern palace. Over here, some are still standing. And this is what the capitals looked at on the top of the pillars, which the Medrash says, Rav Masna said, I saw one of the parachim, the capitals, on top of the pillars of Achashverosh's palace. And these remain, by the way, from Achashverosh's palace. And I was able to stretch out and stretch my arms and legs out and sleep on top of it, which the person literally could do. And the capital that remained from Achashverosh's time. It was so big that he could easily sit 10,000 people in that apadna and make a party for them. And in the reconstruction, we have, let's see, on page 81, Rabbi Landi brings a nice reconstruction over here. So this is Shushan. So here's the palace. So the Atat is over here. It would be number four in the picture with a garden around it. And then the throne room is over here where there's an A. This is the way you come in to the palace ground through this big, large, tremendous gate on the east. Then you go in and you first go, if you're not going to the Padna, which is on the outside there with the gardens, then you go into the palace and get to the large courtyard, the outer courtyard. You go into a middle courtyard, and then you get to number seven, that's the inner courtyard. And that faces directly the throne room, which is eight. The king would sit on the throne, facing directly that inner courtyard, exactly as it is described in the Gilgamesh, when it says when Esther came in and she was, she was standing exactly opposite the king as she walked in. And in fact, there's some stone blood from the courtyard, from the inner courtyard. You could just picture Esther walking on them and saying, Kaylee, Kaylee, Lama Zaftani, Zavin Pekarish Baruch Hu. That plan to work. So that's the palace, and that's it. All the different things that are described in Megillah took place in the places that we could actually ascribe to different parts of the palace. Baruch Hashem, Esther's plan worked. And when she came in, she found the king holding the scepter, and he lifted up the scepter. And all the reliefs, all the pictures of the king sitting on the throne, by the way, he always is holding a golden scepter. And here he is, Ahasuerus, well, it's a Xerxes. This is him, in full glory on page 82, with a golden scepter on the throne, in part of a raised platform. The throne is, of course, all gold. And this is gold, but you can't see it in the relief, because it's stone. So then, what it looked like when he came in to the king's throne room, the way that Xerxes pictured it and had it commissioned to be put onto the wall. In any case, afterwards, at the end of the Megillah, it talks about how Ahasuerus could attack on the different cities of different parts of the kingdom. According to the Targum, Rabbi Shmuel says, the reason he's saying that is to show that the attack is not on the Jews, it's only on other people in the kingdom, because now that he discovered that Esther was from Jewish origin, so now he considered the Jews as part of the reigning nation, and just like the Persians and the Medes never had to pay taxes, the Jews didn't have to pay taxes either, because they're part of the queen's family. So, okay, so to sum things up, well, what can we take away from this? Well, first of all, that the nation that suddenly comes and shows tolerance to the Jews is a big boon, is a big bracha. On the other hand, it certainly has its perils. As Chazal tells us, it was because of the Jews, the Jewish presence in the party of Ahasuerus, that they almost were wiped out in the times of Haman. Meaning that we have to be careful. It's true that the nations, Akkadosh Baruch Hu, Nosan, Chayn, the nations treated, the nations that we're coming from, many of the nations treat us as equals, and democracy is now recognized throughout the globe. Koresh wasn't just fair to the Jews, he was fair to all the subjects of his kingdom. And he gave the Avodah Zarah also their kalim to do their Avodah Zarah. He was fair to all of them. But it's something that we have to be careful about and realize that we're not part of them. The second thing is that Persia was the wealthiest, the greatest of kingdoms. Every king of Persia calls himself the king of kings because they really were the most powerful in history and the wealthiest in history. Where are they? What happened to them? Nothing left. It comes, it goes, Kali still remains. What we have to focus on is not on what the others have and the wealth and the power that Kosh Baruch gives to other nations, but rather on what our mission is. And in Purim, I think we took from Persia a lesson and implemented it into Avodas Hashem, which is, as we know, what the mission of the Jews is, to learn and to learn from each nation what you could do to take the Avodas Hashem. And that is the focus of Purim, where in Purim we take Mishnah v'Simcha. Drinking wine turns into Avodas Hashem. We show that even when we drink wine, like it says in the Gemara, that the guy you say, Magios knows, Parthios knows, and Nei Yisrael sit, and they Kiddush al Yayin, and Shabbos. So even when we drink wine, we take the Mishteh Yayin, and we make that into Avodas Hashem on Purim, in order to show that even when there's no Seichel, Avodas Hashem is all that's left.